This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to Birth Stories with me, Clemmy Hooper, created by Offscript. Just to warn you, this episode contains discussions about stillbirth.
We've probably been talking about it for a while, kind of even probably before we got married, but it was a year after we got married. We thought, okay, let's give it a go. Let's see how we get on. Started trying, I guess, the beginning of that year, and we fell pregnant actually about 4 months later. I actually had an ectopic pregnancy, rushed into hospital and had emergency surgery and lost one of my fallopian tubes. And then we conceived again, I think it was about another 4 months later. I had a bit of morning sickness. I really didn't struggle that much. I look back and I have mixed feelings. I guess I have happy memories of that time. And then, you know, maybe if I'm having a bad day, I'd want to go back and punch that person in the face and just say, you have no idea. You have no idea what's around the corner.
I'm Clemmy Hooper and welcome to Birth Stories, a podcast where I talk to amazing women about the fascinating and unique ways they had their babies. I'm a midwife and a mother of four, and I also run a blog called Gas and Air, where women share their stories of childbirth. Today's guest is clinical psychologist Michelle Tolfrey, who co-founded psychology practice Talking Heads, which offers a range of talking therapies across London. Michelle, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
We've actually met before.
We have.
I presented you with an award at the Tommy's Baby Charity.
You did, yeah, 2 years ago.
And I actually work at the hospital where you had Orla.
Yeah.
And we'll be talking a little bit about your midwife, who I know well.
Yes, who's also called Michelle.
I know, Michelle and Michelle. Hi, Michelle, if you're listening. So you've talked a little bit about your pregnancy and obviously you had your ectopic pregnancy.
I did.
Were you worried about then trying to conceive again? Were you worried about, you know, statistics and chances and things?
I was, but weirdly, I mean, this goes to show how little we know about our bodies. So when the surgeon came, he came and drew some pictures about what he was going to do. And he's like, oh, but your fallopian tubes move around. They're not attached to your ovaries.
Isn't that amazing?
And I was like, what?
That it grabs the egg.
Yeah.
I know. So, I think that is the most weird and magical thing.
I mean, it really blew my mind. Because I guess I was assuming that, okay, well, then my fertility is down to 50%. Mm. But actually, that's not true because you can, if you've still got both ovaries, you could still ovulate from either side. And it was definitely on my mind, but I was kind of less worried than maybe I had been when I first realised that I'd probably lose a tube.
And you had a really straightforward pregnancy, it sounds.
Yeah, I mean, it was everything that I guess I hoped pregnancy would be. Doing lots of preparation. I did a hypnobirthing course. Yeah, did the NCT course as well. I went to so much pregnancy yoga. It was like my addiction. And yeah, I was still working up until I went into hospital to have Orla. So I was one of those annoying people that was just, getting on with life and really enjoying it and getting quite excited for birth, actually, which... Yeah, I mean, obviously it didn't go how I thought it was going to, but I'm glad that I was able to, you know, not be too caught up in the worry of what might happen. Obviously, I look back and I could see sort of how, I was big and I was bloated towards the end. But yeah, I just really enjoyed the whole process.
When did you start to suspect, or you said before that you had a feeling that something wasn't quite right? Are you all right to talk about that?
I think it was the weekend that I ended up going into hospital. I think I just kind of didn't feel quite myself. And I think it's quite hard when you feel like that and you can't really pinpoint it on anything because you feel like you don't really want to bother anyone by just saying, I just feel a bit weird. felt a bit tearful. I think I was just a bit, looking back, probably movements had started to reduce, but, you know, it hadn't been so dramatic that I was really concerned about that. I just kind of didn't feel myself.
And did you go in for a checkup at that point?
I didn't. It was about a day later, that's when I really noticed that movements had changed and really slowed down. So that was when I went into hospital. And that was like a Sunday, late Sunday afternoon when we went in. So asked to be sort of seen by a midwife just to be checked out.
And had you were caseloaded by a team of midwives, weren't you? We still use the very old fashioned pager system.
Yes, yeah. So I'd done that. So I'd phoned the pager system and the midwife on call had called me back. We'd had a quick chat and she just said, look, just pop up. It'll be fine. You know, just go up, get checked, just go and reassure yourself. And you know, I was a very low risk pregnancy. I'd had everything was all within sort of normal ranges. I'd had a 36-week scan just a few days before. Yeah. They'd been absolutely perfect. So, you know, I can see why we would have thought, yeah, it would just be a case of just going up and being told, don't worry, everything's okay.
So how many weeks are you at this point?
37, exactly.
On the Sunday.
Yeah.
So you went up to labour ward.
I did.
And then what happened next?
So we were taken into one of the, I guess, the triage rooms, aren't they? And it was a midwife who took me in and she'd said all the same normal things like urine sample, had a bit of a feel around and tried to pick up the heartbeat with the handheld Doppler. Mm-hmm. And was kind of clearly struggling with that. So then used the big pads for the CTG monitor. And again, I guess I knew that she was struggling to pick something up. And mm-hmm. I still, I guess at that point, still hadn't put two and two together what that might mean. But I was aware that she was quite quiet. And I guess now in reflection, I could see that she probably was getting quite anxious.
Was your husband with you?
He was. He was kind of sat on the other side of the room. I think we were sort of pretty quite clueless about what we didn't realise that this could happen. So then she left and just said, I just need to go and get a doctor to come and help and just get the ultrasound monitor. Mm-hmm. So she came back with the doctor and they wheeled in the monitor and started scanning. And I just remember looking over at the screen and thinking, this doesn't look good. I think when you've had quite a few scans, you know that babies tend to be quite wriggly and there's lots kind of going on. And I just, you know, it was just very still, very, it was like a, more like a photograph than what it should be, like a video. And I just, at that moment, turned my head. I just remember the bed's right next to the wall. I remember turning to look at the wall, thinking, I don't want to look at this anymore because I feel like the ground is just going to give way in a minute. I think something really bad is going to happen. And I just remember her turning off the monitor and putting her hand on my leg and just saying, I'm really sorry. That really is the sort of the moment, I guess, that everything changed. Mm.
Mm. So the doctor obviously broke the completely devastating news that your baby had died. Mm. I mean, this is every parent's worst nightmare. Mm. There is nothing that prepares you for this. There is no discussion in your antenatal classes. There is no discussion with your midwife.
No.
This is the worst possible thing that can happen.
Yeah.
I mean, time must have just stood still and raced past. I mean,
it is odd. It's this weird, because your mind starts racing. I've never experienced anything quite like it, where like the thoughts that were racing through my mind, I felt so out of control. I felt that I just couldn't. I think from the outside, I looked quite calm. Mm. I found it quite difficult where I read other people's stories and they say that they were able to scream and kind of let all their emotion out. I'm quite the opposite, and I sort of really close in and go very quiet. And I didn't cry, and I didn't. Well, maybe I did cry, but it wasn't a huge. I think I was just so shocked.
Yeah.
It was just I felt more frozen than anything. Mm. Thoughts racing, and it's this weird, like the world is kind of moving around you, and you're suspended in this weird parallel universe that you didn't expect to be in.
What conversations then did the doctor, obstetrician and midwife then have with you about what would happen next and your options?
It's an odd one because I felt like suddenly there were lots of people in the room.
Really?
And there was lots of talk of go home, pack a bag, come back, we're going to start induction this
that
evening.
Day.
Yeah. Right. And it's interesting now because, so now having spoken to lots of other people who've actually been left for a few days before starting induction, I didn't feel that that was given to me as an option. I felt like it was, right, that's it, we've got to get this baby out. And
do you know why?
No, I don't. Because then I think, oh, maybe there was a medical reason that they wanted that. But maybe not. I don't know. Mm. It was kind of an odd, but I do remember saying, what do you mean I've got to give birth? I suppose I genuinely thought, surely you're just going to put me to sleep.
Yeah.
Take this baby away. Please don't make me do this. This is not what I signed up for. This is not what I expected. And how on earth can you expect me to go through what I imagine is going to be a very physical, tough experience to, at the end of it, not take a baby home? Like, how can you expect me to do this? I think then there was a lot of talk of it will be better for you in the longer term if you want to go on to have more children. You know, the cesareans carry risks.
Of course. And
you know, I do understand all of that, but this was all being told to me within the space of half an hour of me being told that my baby had just died. So I was like, I don't give a shit really what the long term thing is. All I can think about is in this moment, I don't think I can do what you're asking me to do.
Mm.
But it felt a little bit like that wasn't an option. So
yeah.
I did kind of go off with, I suppose almost a little bit of my tail between my legs of, I feel like I don't have any choice here.
Really?
I don't know whether if I'd pushed back, it would have been different. But, and actually, you know, looking back, I'm glad that things went the way they did.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously in that moment, you're just so powerless. You're so powerless and so vulnerable.
Yeah. So did you go home? I mean, presume you probably already packed your hospital bag.
I mean, I hadn't.
Oh,
I hadn't. I think the sad thing is that, and I look back and I feel this is quite a sad and poignant memory, is that that was the day that I'd kind of felt able to wash all the baby's clothes and start getting ready. So we went home and there's all of these clothes like laid out on the clothes dryer.
Mm.
And I just, you know, they always said, oh, you know, bring an outfit for your baby.
Oh.
You just think, well, which one do you choose? Because this is, they're only going to need one. Picking something and it's still damp because I've just washed it. And that was a very tough evening. It was, again, nothing how I imagined packing my hospital bag to be. It was a case of just rushing around, getting some clothes for me, some clothes for Andy, an outfit for the baby, and then just heading in.
So did you come back on the Monday?
No, I came back Sunday night.
You came back that same
night.
Yeah,
so they started the induction at about, it was probably about 11 p.m. or something by the time they gave me the pessary. Yeah.
So they gave you a pessary. Were you offered pain relief straight away?
I mean, it wasn't so bad that I felt that I needed anything. But I think there was a discussion of whatever you want, you can have.
Mm.
But at that time, I didn't feel like I needed anything.
And then did anything happen overnight or did you manage to sleep? Were you given your own room?
You had your own
single room, of course.
So we had our own room. I mean, it was very broken sleep. It wasn't proper sleep. And I think the pessary did start working. I did start contracting, but it was very slow and steady. It wasn't full-blown labour. It was just the sort of rumblings of it starting. But the lack of sleep was much more about, oh, my God, what's happened?
So
that was a Sunday night. And then my midwife arrived on Monday morning. So she'd basically, when all this had happened, I then phoned back my midwife team. I spoke to the midwife on call, who wasn't my midwife, who was just so lovely. And then she immediately called my midwife, who then immediately called me back.
Oh, on her day off.
On her day off, and just said, I will be there tomorrow. Well, that makes me tearful. I'll be there.
How did that make you feel, knowing she would come in?
It was just knowing that someone who knew me was just going to be there, you know, to make you feel safe.
Yeah.
I don't know how other people get through this without a Michelle.
I know. So Monday comes, obviously you've had hardly any sleep and you've still got to get into proper labour. So the way the pessary works, as you now know, it's to soften your cervix to get you favourable. I hate using that word in midwifery terms. So then did they try and break your waters?
They didn't actually. I think I was progressing, so they kind of left me to keep progressing. And oh gosh, it was a long day. I think it just kind of was getting more and more intense through the day. The pessary did work quite well, but I think it was late afternoon and I was like, actually, I'm really tired now. And I'd been trying so hard to use all the hypnobirthing things, but actually because so much of it is about getting into the zone and using certain, I guess, affirmations and things, they felt so beyond what my experience was that I couldn't do it. I couldn't calm my mind. I couldn't, those affirmations of I'll soon meet my baby, I take on a different meaning when it's like, I'm going to meet my baby and my baby's going to be dead. And so I think it was, late afternoon, I then asked for, I thought, what do you get injected in your bum?
Pethidine or dimorphine?
I think it was pethidine. I think I had that.
Mm.
I think then I had the drip to get the contractions going
a bit more. The syntocinol.
Yeah. So I had that. And when I had that, then I'm like, right, that's it. I want all the drugs.
Yeah.
So then I had the amazing dimorphine where you can self-administer.
Yeah.
Which, that was pretty awesome.
Really?
I mean, my pupils were like pinpricks.
Are you high as a kite?
The hospital food was the best food I'd ever eaten in that moment. I was like, Andy, you've got to try this stuff. It's great. And he was just thinking, what on earth has happened?
It's weird that you could have felt some euphoria and happiness in such a traumatic time.
There's definitely moments in that where there was kind of laughter and smiling and it was this weird kind of bubble that we were in that room.
Yeah.
I went into that room on Sunday evening and I didn't leave until Tuesday morning.
Mm.
And there are moments of kind of lightness within that day. But yeah, it was by that point I was like, give me all the drugs.
And at any point in your labour, did you ask your midwife or did you talk to her about, you know, what Orla might look like and what to expect?
Yeah.
Because that's something, whenever I look after women who have had a loss, I really try to encourage, because sometimes I think, and this is a very natural thing, as a human, you think the worst and you think horror.
Yeah.
And actually, babies are so beautiful and perfect.
Mm.
And I know some parents don't want to see their babies because they're so fearful of how they may look. And actually, the reality is that they just look like
babies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We did. I suppose there's a lot of time when you're having an induced labour. There's a lot of time, isn't there, sort of waiting and sitting around. So we'd been given, Michelle came in and gave us all the leaflets from SANS.
Mm-hmm. So for any listeners, SANS is the Stillbirth and Neonatal Death Charity, which provide support and also lots of, as you discuss, information leaflets, helping you kind of make those really difficult decisions on what to do when your baby's died.
There's a lot of really good information there about things you can do with your baby to make memories, and then other things like how to plan funerals and stuff that, you know, I think it was very helpful to read that during that time. But it's also just sometimes you're reading it and you think, what on earth is my life right now? What am I doing? Because I knew Michelle and I trusted her, I could say, look, I am really scared about seeing my baby. What happens if I don't like them? What happens if I don't love them? Like, how am I going to feel any connection to this baby when I don't, you know, I'm scared of seeing them. I'm very scared. I was just so scared to touch my bump after I found out that she died, because it's a very horrible, I guess, sensation where, when you're full term, you're big and it's kind of, your baby's kind of very there. If you touch them, they just kind of bounce back. I found that very traumatic, actually.
Yeah.
So it was very hard to then feel scared of my own bump, my own baby.
And your own body.
Yeah, you just feel, and then you just feel awful for that. Like, oh, how what kind of mum am I to feel this way? It's, I'd certainly got into that cycle of real beating myself up about.
Already.
Yeah. How did this happen? This is my fault. It's a time of lots of kind of, self-criticism and blame. For me anyway, it was.
So then the epidural finally was given to you on the Monday night.
Monday night. So, yeah, I'd had all the other drugs, and then I think even that kind of just wasn't touching the sides, and my mind had just, I'd kind of lost it, really. I had no focus. I couldn't get into a rhythm. I couldn't, I just couldn't breathe through that anymore. So I just said, look, give me the epidural. I think also because the Syntocin, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite intense, isn't
it? Very,
very. So the contractions were big and they were strong, and I was just like, no, I'm too exhausted. So then the epidural came.
Did you then get some relief?
Yeah, I actually decided to try and get some sleep, actually.
Yeah.
Because I know I wasn't anywhere near ready to push. So,
do you know how many centimetres you were?
I can't remember, actually. I've got a feeling it was somewhere around 4 or 5. So it wasn't... quite a way off. So I tried to have a sleep. I think Andy had a bit of a sleep on the floor. Michelle went off to have a sleep, and because there'd been, through the day, other midwives had joined and gone, so some from the team.
Great relief each other.
Yeah, but they were all really kind. They were all really kind. And I was never left on my own. There was always someone kind of there. So we tried to get a bit of sleep. And then before I tried to get some sleep, they broke my waters as well.
Right.
After I'd had the epidural, which was, that was quite the shock. There was so much.
There was
so much. And I think even the midwife who, because I think Michelle was sleeping at that time, even the midwife who did it was like, that. There's a lot of water there. And there was meconium in the water, which they said that may have been after she died. Quite common. Maybe it was there before. Maybe she'd been distressed and that had been, I guess we'll never know.
How did that make you feel?
It's always just quite hard to think about, gosh, was she in distress in those last few hours? I mean, it's a very painful thing to have to live with as a mum.
Yeah.
But I think by that point, in that moment, I was just like, oh, I'm so tired. This is just so awful. Can someone just put me to sleep?
You just want everything over.
You do. It's a weird thing, you do and you don't. Because it's like, while I'm in labour and this is happening, I can pretend that this is not real. I can pretend that, oh, actually, maybe she's going to come out. At that point, I didn't know whether she was a she, but this is all just going to be a big dream. So it was a real, I want this over, but I don't, because I don't really know what's on the other side of this moment.
So obviously you get fully dilated and you start pushing.
Yeah, I remember this well. The midwife was with me. He's like, you know, you can start if you want. I was like, no, I'm not starting until Michelle's back. And she's like, but it might take a little while. And I was like, no, I'm not starting until she's here. I was like, because I think I was just so scared that it might happen quickly and then she wouldn't be there. And I really wanted her there.
Oh.
And then obviously when Michelle did come back, it took a long time. I was
Do you remember how long you were pushing for?
So I've got a feeling that I might have started pushing around 4 or 5 a.m. and she wasn't born until about 7:30.
Right.
I found that really quite brutal. I thought it felt long. And maybe it wasn't even that long, but...
It may well have been.
Yeah, it felt hard. And I think Michelle was saying this actually, when a baby is alive, they're working with you. You're doing this together. When your baby's died, you have to do all the work.
Yeah.
They're not helping you out at all because they can't. And I think there was a point where I think we were just thinking, is this going to happen? Are we going to need any kind of help or intervention? And I know that they were all very reluctant to do that, because the trouble is, if you do that with a baby who's died, then they can't bounce back from any injury that may be caused. So I don't even know whether that was kind of discussed or... But anyway, that gave me the final kind of push to just, all right, that's it, I'm doing this. And she was born at... about 7:30 on the Tuesday morning.
And when she was born, obviously Michelle, your midwife, was there.
Mm.
Had you discussed whether you wanted her skin to skin? Did you want all the things, I guess, if she was alive?
I was too scared.
Yeah.
I was too scared. And it makes me feel, I feel guilty for that, but then I also feel, and I don't at the same time, because I have developed a deep compassion for the person I was in that moment, who was actually someone very vulnerable.
Of course.
So I just said, can you take the baby away and kind of maybe get them, wrap them up or something, mm-hmm. because I don't feel ready to see them straight away. But I just remember kind of lying there and gripping onto the bed and just thinking, I don't want to open my eyes because I don't want this to be over. I want it to be over and I don't. And I'm just too scared. What happens if I open my eyes and see something that is just going to finish me off?
Yeah.
So I just remember having my eyes squeezed shut and Michelle sort of taking baby into the little kind of room next to where we were. And I just remember her calling out and saying, do you want to know what you've had?
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. She's like, oh, you've had a little girl. Yeah. It's just sad, isn't it? Because it's just not what you imagined. It's not how I imagined finding out. But it's a nice memory.
It's the way even you described how Michelle shared what gender your baby was. You've had a little girl.
Yeah.
You know, in the darkest of moments, even she could find this amazing thing. You know, your baby is a girl, not was. She is. Yeah. You know, you have a daughter.
You have a little girl. And, you know, then I just remember saying, oh, she's beautiful. And do you want me to bring her through now?
And where at this point was Andy very much just your husband, just with you?
Yeah. Yeah. So he was next to me. And yeah, I just remember him saying, oh, well done. Well done. You did it. Yeah. And I suppose because there was another midwife there from the team who, I don't know whether she'd done it at that point or afterwards, or taking hand and footprints. But I remember her being brought through to me, wrapped up in loads of towels. And
with just her face showing?
Yeah, just her face showing. And I think her little hands were sort of poking out.
What did she look like?
She just looked really peaceful and she just looked like she was sleeping. She was covered in loads of vernix.
Oh, was she?
Oh, she had so much. Like, she was very, very kind of covered.
So vernix is that creamy, supposed to be the world's best moisturiser that baby's skin is covered in utero. So it keeps, because they live in water, keeps their skin not from being dry.
Yeah.
And especially babies that are a little bit early, you'd expect them to be covered in. It's very sticky and white.
Yes, it was very thick.
Did you hold her at that point?
Yeah. So then I had her and I think I had the injection to deliver the placenta and all of that sort of was, I felt like that a lot of that was kind of going on around me and I couldn't move that much because I'd had the epidural, so I'd had a catheter and I just remember sitting up in bed and being able to hold her. And
did you talk to her?
Yeah, there was just lots of lots of looking and stroking and cuddling and Andy had a hold. I think the thing that I'm really grateful for Michelle as well is that she really encouraged me to open up all the towels and just look at all of her and to take photos of all of her.
Are you really glad you did that?
So glad. They're not photos that I share with anyone.
No.
They're really personal.
Of course.
But there's something so, like, she was real. And I think sometimes you kind of, if you only see their face or you've got, I guess we have lots of like black and white photos as well. But these are full colour photos of her whole body, of me sort of holding her and her whole body. And I'm just like, no, she's a whole person, a real person. She existed. And I'm so glad I have those photos.
Yeah. At what point did you give her name? Had you already pick names for girls and boys? I'm sure you probably discussed names at length in pregnancy.
We had a few different ones. We decided really quickly, actually. We'd had a sort of various like long lists of names and it hadn't been decided completely. But I think we just sort of felt that this feels like a really good name for her. So
what does it mean?
It means Golden Princess. It's an Irish name. And it just felt right. I don't know. I people say that, don't they? And they're like, oh, they look like a so-and-so.
Yeah. I think you do know, don't you?
Yeah, I think so.
And did you have the opportunity to spend as much time as you and Andy needed with her?
We did. I think this is a tricky thing that I have very kind of mixed emotions about, I guess. So we were taken then from the labour ward down to, actually it was, I guess, I think it's the antenatal ward. Mm. And they had a side room there, but it wasn't a bereavement suite. Mm. So I do feel quite cross about that. I do feel cross at the hospital didn't have a bereavement suite. I didn't know that existed until sort of subsequently. Now I'm very kind of involved in the loss community. I do know that there are some amazing resources out there. But so being put in this side room, and whilst it's slightly separate, you can see out into the main ward. So you can see lots of women walking around who are pregnant, and that's actually very distressing. And the room is hotter than the sun. Mm. There were no cold cots at that time. So yeah, I often find like it's hard to sort of talk about this because I think, oh, I don't want to distress people, but this is the reality. But, you know, when you have a body that is no longer alive, mm-hmm. and you put them in a really hot room, they start to change and deteriorate, yeah. very quickly. And that's quite upsetting in that I felt that our time with her was limited because of that.
Mm.
It was just too distressing to see her change so quickly. So we went down to that room probably about, I don't know, 9 a.m. And by 5 p.m., we were like, I think it's time that we need to go. And there was no rush. We could have stayed as long as we wanted. Mm-hmm. But I didn't feel the option was that she kind of gets taken away and put somewhere cool for a while and then come back. And as a mum, you know, you're being separated from your baby,
yeah.
knowing that they're not, you know, they're not going somewhere else to be cared for. They're going somewhere to be cooled. That was just, I just couldn't do that. So it got sort of 5 p.m. and I was just like, I think we both agreed that it's probably time to go.
Were you given the opportunity to dress her, or did your midwife do all of that?
So I had no experience of babies before I had her. I had no idea sort of how to do anything, and I felt so anxious that I was going to damage her in some way. And I really regret now not being involved in that. I kind of think, I wish maybe I'd given her a bath, or I'd taken the opportunity to dress her. But I just, in that moment, I couldn't. Mm. I just couldn't do it.
And then you decided to go home.
Yeah, we decided to go home.
Which must just be the most difficult experience, to leave a hospital without your baby.
Mm, it's just surreal. I think it's those small things that people would never even, you would never know unless you'd been there. But, you know, you're in a room with your baby, and the two options are you hand your baby over to someone else for them to take them away.
Mm.
And you're in that moment, I guess, you're not sure whether you're ever going to see them again.
In the mortuary, you mean?
Yeah. That you just think, like, is this the final moment? So you just think, well, do I hand them over, or do I leave them in the room and walk out of the room? And both of them, I mean, it's just an impossible decision. Which one is the best? Like, they're both horrific. They're both just horrendous. I think we decided in the end that I needed to give her to someone to feel like I was passing over the care of her to someone else. I couldn't walk out of that room and leave her. Like, it just felt like I was abandoning her.
Mm.
Yeah, that was a pretty horrific moment, actually.
So the midwife, you handed all to the midwife, yeah. And she took her.
And, you know, all the midwives, they treated her with such respect and care and dignity. And whilst you kind of know that, well, there's so little that you can do, but those small things are massive.
Of course.
They're huge.
Mm. So after you decided to give Orla to one of the midwives, yeah. and leave the hospital, obviously one question and decision that would have been very difficult for you and your husband to make was whether or not to have a post-mortem,
yeah.
which
yeah.
is when they carry out extensive testing, mm-hmm. on all parts of the baby to see possibly why and how this happened. What was your sort of decision-making around that?
It's such an odd one because you just, it's such an odd decision to make. We desperately needed to know that we'd exhausted all avenues in terms of finding out what had happened for our own sort of peace of mind, but also just thinking about if we were to have another baby, this, you know, would this happen again? Could this happen again? But the thought of handing over your baby to be, you know, essentially sort of in the most kind of graphic terms, but taken apart was just felt, it just felt too much. And we were really lucky that we had an option of having a, actually don't know what the technical term is, but like a non-intrusive post-mortem.
Oh, right.
They do them at Great Ormond Street Hospital. Oh, right. So we actually opted for that. We'd been prepared from that moment that we'd been told that that she died, that there probably wouldn't be an explanation.
Right.
Because I was a low-risk pregnancy, that there had been no other signs. I'd had a scan a few days before. And it came back and said there was no known cause.
Right.
Which is, it's like a double-edged sword. Mm. It's a relief, but it's also just quite traumatic to think, well, but how does this happen? How do babies just die and there's no cause? Although I like to think that there is a cause, we just don't know what that is because it's very hard to understand and check what's going on when it's inside of you. So, yeah, tough decision, but I'm glad we made that decision.
How then, and now continue into your journey, I guess, how do you find, you know, space and time to keep Orla's memory alive?
It's such a tricky balance because life does kind of continue and you have to find a way to continue living your life alongside your grief and everything that you've been through. And also now that we're parenting after loss, we've had another baby. Obviously, babies that you take home are quite time-consuming and all-consuming. And so I think that is, parenting after loss is a whole other, it's a whole other podcast. It's a very big, kind of complicated journey, I think. But we talk about Orla a lot. She has, you know, her photos are up around the house, things like her handprints and footprints are. One thing I do every single day without fail is I write her name in the steam of the shower every day. Every single day. And it just feels like it's that just one moment in that, you know, even if I don't have lots of thoughts about her through the rest of the day, there's one moment in every day that I connect with her. And that feels just important to me. Mm. And I over time, I've learned I don't beat myself up for not doing lots of stuff, but she's always there. She's part of me. So she gets weaved in at different times. Mm-hmm. And now our other daughter knows her name and will say her name and go up to her photo and stroking her. Orla. Which is really nice.
Each week, my guest and I take a question and try to answer it together. You're ready, Michelle?
I'm ready. Okay. Ready.
I'm pregnant with my second child, a boy, and I'm so excited to meet him, but absolutely dreading giving birth. I found my daughter's birth 3 years ago was hugely traumatic. The doctors were worried about her heartbeat and had found some meconium, so I had to have an emergency section. And then she was taken away by the baby doctors, so I wasn't allowed to see or hold her for a long time. I just wanted to be reassured that the same thing won't happen again, but I know it's out of my control. What can I do? Big question.
That's a tough one. Yeah.
So sorry you had such a traumatic birth. That's horrible.
That sounds really horrible.
Really horrid.
I mean, for me, I think it was just really important to be able to have those conversations with my midwife kind of from the beginning about these are my worries and what can we do together? Because you're not in it on your own. I think it's really important to know that you're not
definitely
doing this by yourself.
Yeah, and no one expects you to.
Yeah.
You don't need to be, you know, I can do this.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got a team because we care.
Yeah,
you need that team in birth.
Exactly. One of the things actually I found really helpful in preparing for birth after having a very difficult time was going to visit the labour ward again.
Did you go back?
Yeah, because I just thought I don't want the first time for me to go back to be either when I'm having the baby, or if I, you know, if I'm anxious and I'm going for a check, I don't know whether I'm going to be very traumatized by this. So it's really important for me to prepare and have visits and kind of desensitize myself to that environment again.
That's a really good idea. And was that something you just arranged through the hospital?
I just did it with my midwife.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I was lucky that I had a caseloading midwife.
Yeah.
But yeah, I did that through her.
I always advise women who've had any traumatic birth to make sure they have like a proper debrief. Any hospital offers it. You just can contact PALS or your midwife if you're still in contact with them, and then they can pull your notes and you can actually sit down with a midwife or an obstetrician and go through your notes and actually see what happened and also understanding why. I think when something quite traumatic like this birth she's described happens, sometimes time can be very blurred in your memory, and actually when it's written out in our notes because they're so detailed, I think sometimes that can be quite helpful.
That sounds really good.
Yeah. I would say, especially if you've done the things that Michelle and I recommended, really writing out a detailed kind of, well, I call them birth preferences.
Yeah.
Things like, if my baby for whatever reason needs to be taken away from me to have additional support with breathing, please communicate that with me.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the time it's down to communication. When women aren't explained and told what's happening at the time by any health professional in the room,
it's really scary.
It's so scary for you.
Yeah, definitely. I think also, I guess it's important to flag up about kind of perinatal mental health services. You might be able to offer some support in relation to seeing if there is kind of any sort of trauma there, and do you need some psychological support to work through that, and just what kind of strategies might be helpful in terms of managing anxiety. Because whilst I wasn't so anxious necessarily for birth, I was very anxious about everything else.
Yeah.
So it's really important that I did some work around managing my anxiety as much as I could, whilst also acknowledging that it's going to be there. I mean, there are people who can support you around kind of your sort of mental health and well-being in pregnancy.
Thanks, Michelle. It's really interesting to have your input. And thank you so much to our listener for writing in. If you have a question you'd like me on the podcast to try and answer, please email birthstoriespodcast@gmail.com. Michelle, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having
and
me.
And telling us about your birth and sharing your story about Orla. How can people find out more about you?
I mean, there's probably the easiest way is through my blog and my Instagram, which is From the Other Chair. And then kind of work-wise, my company's called Talking Heads. We do have an Instagram page, but actually it's probably easier just to look up our website, which is talkingheads.org.uk. And that's just got some information on there about mental health and different types of therapies and where to access help if you were looking for it.
Thank you for listening to Birth Stories with me, Clemmie Hooper. Remember to subscribe on your favourite podcast app so that you can listen as soon as the podcast comes out each week. And please rate it and leave a review if you have time. You can find more Birth Stories on my blog, Gas and Air, and you can find me on Instagram at Mother of Daughters. Birth Stories was produced by Hannah Varrell and created by Offscript.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.